would continue discussing today's Kalman-Mandula theorem. And so before we went and studied isomorphisms between Lorentz group and SL2C group, we showed that if we want to have a non-trivial interacting theory, then we cannot have a conserved charges which which transform as tensors of rank 2 under Lorentz group. And of course, it doesn't prove the Kalman-Mandula theorem, but it was, in my opinion, it's a nice, nice example to illustrate the point. So let's go ahead and discuss the extension of the Lorentz Poincaré algebras that actually will work. And so what we will do, we will now consider to begin with, again, we will start with a free theory. So this is a theory where we have we have a free complex scalar, and then we have a wild fermion, del mu psi, and then here we have psi psi. And so last lecture, we actually discussed a lot the index structure here. So by this, I mean this, okay? And then we have, that's a contraction of indices here. And yeah, this is just a complex scalar field. So again, we can look at this free theory, and we can construct infinitely many conserved currents, which transform which have half integer spin, so can construct infinitely many conserved currents. And again, that's not a contradiction with Kalman-Mandula theorem because we deal with a theory that is free. So I'm just going to write down two such currents, and we will verify for one of them that it's conserved. So it's del rho of phi bar, and then we have sigma rho, sigma bar mu, and then here I have psi. And I look at index alpha here. All right, so that's one current, and then there is another one. So del rho phi bar sigma rho sigma bar mu del mu psi. Again, I take alpha. So I'm going to use mu nu to indicate tensor indices, and I will use alpha beta alpha dot beta dot to indicate spinor indices. So again, what I would like to show now is that, in particular in relation to this current, that it is conserved. And what it conserved means is that when I evaluate the divergence of this current on the equations of motion, so I need to use equations of motion, I should get zero. So let's do this simple exercise. So the first thing we need to derive the equation of motion coming from that free Lagrangian. So for a scalar, for a complex scalar, we have box phi equal to zero. We've seen this before. Now for this one, the equation that I should get is when I vary for the fermion, I will vary the action with respect to psi bar, okay? If I do that, so notice that that's where the place where psi bar enters, so I need to move a derivative. Again, as usual, I will discard the boundary terms, and then the derivative will act on psi, so we will have minus with a minus sign, sigma bar mu dimensional side. Okay? And there is a derivative here. Okay, so this is an equation of motion for a Weyl fermion. Okay? So given this equation of motion, what we want to show, we want to show that the first current is conserved. And so in order to do that, as I said, we need to evaluate del mu on the current. Now, the current is quadratic in the field, so I can act with mu either on a scalar or on a fermion. And so there will be two terms here. Okay, so this is when I act on the scalar. And then here I have sigma rho, sigma bar mu psi. And I need to take the alpha index of that expression. So that's one term. And then there is another term. And the other term, when I act with the mu derivative on the Weyl fermion, so I will have for the scalar sigma rho, sigma bar mu, del mu psi, I need to take alpha component. Okay, so this combination here, we recognize from the equation of motion that it must vanish. So this whole term vanishes due to the equation of motion for the Weyl fermion, and we are left just with the first term. Okay, now we need to massage this first term somehow in order to get zero. So how do we do this? Well, we notice that del del is actually a symmetric differential operator. So I might as well write it down in this way. And then I symmetrize with respect to mu and mu indices and put a factor of 1/2. So sigma rho, sigma bar mu, plus sigma mu, sigma bar rho, psi. And then I will take alpha index here. Okay, and so that's a place where we can use some of the sigma matrix identities, because the quantity here is up to Kronecker symbols in fermionic indices is just -2 eta mu nu. And so what we have that this expression becomes minus del mu del rho phi bar. And then I have eta mu nu. And the Kronecker symbols will simply instruct us to pick up the alpha's component of the Weyl fermion psi. Okay? And so this is minus box of phi bar. And then I have psi alpha. And that vanishes. Because, you know, I also have, of course, I have a conjugate equation of motion as well. Yeah, sorry, thank you. Eta mu rho, so that will still, that will contract it into a box. All right, very good. So we showed that the first current is conserved, and you can do exactly the same, sort of the same manipulation to show that this one is conserved as well. And as I was saying, it's not a surprise because the theory is non-interactive. So we can have many conserved currents. So it turns out that so given this current, we can construct the conserved charge, and in the first case, the conserved charge will carry a spin index alpha, and we can get this conserved charge by integrating the zeros component of the conserved current over the whole space. Okay, now in the second case. We will get a conserved charge which carries both a tensor index and a spinner index, well, nu alpha will be equal to S0 nu, nu alpha d3x. Okay? So in this particular case, we have two conserved charges. Now, again, following our previous discussion, we can ask what kind of interactions, interactions will conserve those charges, or there will be a suitable modification that the modified charges will be conserved as well. And it turns out that in this case, and we'll come to this question later, we can introduce interaction of this type, phi psi alpha plus Hermitian conjugate plus g squared absolute value of phi to the fourth, where g is a coupling constant. So the model that will give rise, this is actually, if you wish, the simplest Wezzumino model. So here we have an interacting theory, and it is possible to show that we can construct an analogous, or there will be perturbative modification of this current, which will still be conserved and will lead to a conserved spin 1/2 charge. So we'll come back to this. However, possible to show that above interactions, will still conserve suitably modified Q alpha. So just running a little bit ahead, what we will actually show, we will actually, this spinner charges will happen to be supersymmetry charges. And so what we will show that this type of interaction will preserve supersymmetry. So there will be conserved charges associated with supersymmetry transformation, and that there will be a corresponding supercurrent. And so this, in fact, is the expression for the supercurrent in the limit of vanishing coupling. And since the supersymmetry will be unbroken, we will discuss this in a little bit later, then there will be, and we can work out actually explicitly what the conserved supercharges. Yes?
So phi
to the fourth, that's absolute value. No, it's a scalar field, so this is just phi bar squared. So right, it's a complex. So we started with a theory which has so I told you that this theory, this is, if you wish, our first encounter with a supersymmetric interacting four-dimensional field theory. And so we have a complex scalar field and a Weyl fermion. So Weyl fermion has two fermionic degrees of freedom. Again, this we'll discuss this in more details, starting with a simpler model. And we need, you have heard that one of the properties of the supersymmetric model that you have the same number of fermionic and bosonic degrees of freedom. That's why, in particular, we need to have a complex scalar here. So without the fermion, this would be your lambda phi to the fourth field theory. And so if you wish, this is a supersymmetric extension of your simplest lambda phi to the fourth field theory with a complex scale, a complex massless scale. Okay? Non-renormalizable interactions. We will discuss this. You will see in a second that, in fact, one way how we can construct supersymmetric field series, and that's the way how people were doing it in a pre-Zyberg era. So they were, you write down the Lagrangian, and then you try to construct supercharges. And you want to construct supersymmetry generators and show that your Lagrangian is invariant under the supersymmetry transformations. What you will learn in this course within the next two or three lectures is that there is a much easier way to construct supersymmetric field theories. And that's a superfield formalism. So once we develop a superfield formalism, it will be clear that, that whatever we will write down using this superfield formalism will lead to a supersymmetric field series. And then the challenge would be actually to go back from a superfield formalism to something that you used to in your ordinary quantum field series, writing it. So this is the expression for the interactions, for the potential energy, written in components of the superfield. So a superfield will be an object that will combine bosonic and fermionic degrees of freedom and will treat it naturally on the same footing. And it turns out that in that language, formulating supersymmetric field theories is very easy. And then there will be an explicit framework how, given the superfield formalism, we go back to here. And that would involve computing integrals over Grassmann variables of this, in fact, it will be a superpotential. But we'll talk about that. So for now, the statement I want to make is that so we convinced ourselves that as long as we stay with bosons, there is nothing we can do. Okay, there is no interesting generalization of Poincaré algebra can be made. And so the next natural step is to consider series that involve both bosons and fermions. And that's the simplest example in which there are conserved currents of half-integer spin. They lead to conserved half-integer charges, and so those are the objects that are not forbidden by Kalman-Mandula theorem. Okay. All right. Very, very good. So, but now it turns out that you might think that so there will be maybe infinitely many possible ways of extending Poincaré algebras by including these half integer conserved spin charges. And the answer is no. In fact, what I want to argue that you cannot extend anything other than by those supercharges. And I'm not going to give you a full proof, so the full proof exists. But I'm just going to argue that just using what we already know. So let's look at suppose there are interactions. So now we want to make an argument that would lead to a contradiction. So what I want to show that there is no interaction that would preserve this this charge, even though it's a half integer. So we want to show that there are no interactions that would preserve Q nu alpha, or for that reason, any higher half integer spin charges. Okay. So how are we going to do this? Well, let's recall some simple facts about operators. Okay, and then we'll go from there. So suppose I have an operator O, right? And I have a Hermitian conjugate of that operator. So O is an operator on some Hilbert space, okay? And there is a corresponding conjugate operator, which I'm gonna call O dagger. So this is just the dagger of O. And so I'm gonna make a statement that if this operator O is not identically equal to zero, then the anti-commutator of O and O dagger cannot vanish. Okay? So unless the operator is identically zero, then the commutator doesn't vanish. So how can we, have you seen this guys before? Is that an obvious statement to you? No? Should I go through this exercise? No, anti-commutative. It's a two-line thing, so we might as well can go through that. So if the operator is not identically zero, so proof. So if O is not identically zero, then it means that there is a state in the Hilbert space. I'm gonna call this state N, such that On is not equal to zero, okay? That's what we mean that the operator is not identically zero. And so what I'm gonna do, I'm just gonna look at the anti-commutator of this operator evaluated on that state, okay? So this, once I open up this anti-commutator, right, so this is O, O dagger plus O dagger O acted on N, and I can write this down as O acted on N absolute value squared plus O dagger acted on N absolute value squared, and right? So is that clear? So now by assumption, we took a state that is not being annihilated by our operator O. So that tells us that those two things cannot be equal to zero. So it must be some positive number. And so in fact, but this is also an anti-commutator. So we showed that anti-commutator cannot be identically a zero operator because there is a state in the Hilbert space on which its web does not vanish. So I guess I have to be more precise here. And what I mean here is that it's not identical to zero. All right, so very good. So so what I can do now, there's my note. Good. So now I can take that conserved charge, eta alpha, and I can construct its Hermitian conjugate. So it will be Q, will have the index Q bar, will have a spinner index, a dotted spinner index. And because those two operators are Hermitian conjugate, to each other. So if we assume that they are not zero, okay, assuming that Q eta alpha is not identically equal to zero, so according to this simple argument that I just gave you, the anti-commutator Q nu alpha Q bar nu alpha dot cannot be identically zero. Sorry? I want to use exactly the same nu. So then it will really follow up everything that we discussed. Because, you know, it must be the same nu because I want to use an operator which is a Hermitian conjugate of this. There is no summation, right? So nu is a fixed index. All right, so it's clear. So now we can ask, so suppose there is some extension, including interactions, some extension of a Poincaré algebra that would involve this anti-commutator. right? So we can ask ourselves that if each of these charges is conserved and their anti-commutative of two charges is not zero, there should be something on this right-hand side, right? And this something must be not zero. And so the thing that we ask is what are the Lorentz properties of the conserved quantities? So must be conserved. So if this guy conserved, so if each of these charges is conserved by assumption Q nu alpha is conserved, so whatever it is on the right-hand side in this algebra must be conserved as well. I'm just going to write it down. So this equals to some right-hand side, and this must be conserved as well. Right? Well, let's do addition of angular momenta. This is an object of spin 3 half, right? So we have one tensor index, and we have one spinner index. So in particular, there will be some components here that will transform a spin 1 half. And then there is another charge. It's also spin 3 half. So if I want to decompose this into irreducible representation under Lorentz group, then this right-hand side will contain various conserved quantities of Lorentz spin, which will come from the addition of these two spins. And so in particular, there will be a conserved quantity. There must be a conserved quantity of spin 3 under the Lorentz group. Okay. So again, the logic is very simple. We take the anti-commutator. It's something that transforms, forms a representation. In general, it will be a reducible representation of a Lorentz group. We decompose it into irreducible representation. And because the object, it's a bilinear in a spin 3 half object, some of the component must be a spin 3 object. So what we are showing is that if there are interactions that would conserve a spin 3 half charge, then exactly the same interactions must conserve a spin 3 charge. But spin 3 charge is a tensor charge, and it's forbidden by a Kalman-Mandola theorem to be conserved. Okay? So we ran with you into a contradiction. We assume that there are interactions that would allow a conservation of spin 3 half, and then we led to a statement that a spin 3 is conserved. Okay? And there is no way we can, we can extend the sort of Kalman-Mandula arguments by including some extra generators, but the statement of the Kalman-Mandula theorem that we can never change is that there are conserved charges of higher spin. Yes. Because they transform under Lorentz. So one thing is that one of the assumptions of Kalman-Mandula theorem is a Lorentz invariant. So which means that my theory must be Lorentz invariant. So if I would allow things to get mixed in between themselves, then I will break Lorentz symmetry. Right? Right? Okay. So very good. Right, what changes is you have spin 1 half, yeah. And this is exactly what I wanted to write. Spin 1 half and spin 1 half will give you either spin 0 or spin 1, and we already have an element of a spin 1 conserved charge in the Poincaré algebra, and that's energy that's P mu. Okay, so in other words, we can have on the right-hand side a tensor object that are already present, that are not forbidden by a Coleman-Mandula theorem. And that's why one, as you pointed out, one half should be allowed, because we already have objects that are present there. And so that's indeed what I'm going to say. So there is an extension of a Poincaré algebra. So we have the standard algebra, and I'm just going to write down the extension involving these spinor charges. Now there is a spin statistics theorem which tells us that whenever we have a conserved quantity of a half integer spin, then it enters, so the algebra will be graded, and we have to talk about anti-commutators rather than commutators for spin one half. So that's, if you wish, something that was missed in the original no-go theorem of Coleman and Mandula, because they did not allow anti-commutators. So we have the standard Poincaré algebra. And so, which was pretty much everything we could get using the Coleman-Mandula theorem and assumptions that went into it. And then the only possible extension is to include the spin one-half charges. So I can as well write down the algebra, the closed algebra that is doing that. So, and it is this algebra. Q alpha, Q beta, anti-commutator of Q alpha dot, Q beta dot bar also vanishes, and those supercharges commute with C menu. Q alpha dot. So what we wrote with you a super Poincaré algebra. And the claim is that that's the most general thing you can write down using the assumptions of the Coleman-Mandula theorem, which is Lorentz invariants, locality of the scattering, and analyticity of the scattering amplitudes. Okay? Now, in principle, so let me just mention some of the facts. And again, there is a literature where everything this is precise, and my purpose here is to give you an intuitive understanding of what's going on. So on the right-hand side, so people asked, oh, well, you know, there are other generators of the Poincaré algebra. There are generators of Lorentz transformations. So can you write down some algebra where on the right-hand side you will have the generators of the Lorentz transformation? And the answer is no, you cannot. So the statement is Lorentz generators cannot appear on right-hand side, because the resulting algebra will no longer be associated. Okay, so the Lorentz generators are forbidden by the associativity of the algebra. So then you can ask, can there be scalars that show up on the right-hand side? So scalar charges, can scalar charges show up on right-hand side? Okay, and the answer to this is yes. However, it turns out that the appearance of scalar charges in a supersymmetry algebra on the right-hand side would imply that I have to take multiple copies of this algebra. Okay? So what this means that that it will no longer be a minimal supersymmetric algebra. Okay? So this is a minimal Susi algebra. Right? And so the statement is that the scalars can appear on the right-hand side of supersymmetry algebra, but Susi is no longer minimal. Okay. Which is not bad. No longer minimal, and in fact, what we will have extended the so-called extended supersymmetry algebras. They're very interesting and lead to a very interesting field series. So on the right-hand side, I'm going to write down something that will still give me a valid algebra. So it will be an associative algebra, which will have conserved charges besides those that I wrote. So there is a possible extension of that algebra that will include additional scalar charges. No, that's energy momentum vector, right? So I'm talking about the scalar. See, P mu carries a vector index, right? So it's a spin one chart. I'm talking about the scalars. And so the statement is that as long as you want the minimal extension of the Poincaré algebra, then the scalars cannot appear. The scalars can appear when we talk about extended supersymmetry. An example of extended supersymmetry is something that many of you have heard. It's, the gauge theory dual to string theory in ADS spaces. So that's n equal 4 supersymmetric Young-Mills. So a supersymmetry in that field theory is actually extended supersymmetry. Moreover, it's a maximally extended supersymmetry. So hopefully later in the course we will discuss an example of field theories with extended supersymmetry. That's the so-called Seibert-Witten model, which have a very beautiful solution. However, there is a reason why people for quite some time were not actively studying those theories. The reason is that so you tell yourself, okay, so I want a theory which has this extended supersymmetry. What kind of spectrum of particles do I have? And you can prove that that if you have if you try to formulate gauge theories with extended supersymmetries, then you have fermions in those theories which are not chiral. So you cannot have chiral fermions in theories with extended supersymmetries, and that contradicts the standard model. Okay. So in other words, in theories with extended supersymmetries, fermions can be only in real representation of gauge symmetries, if you wish. So for this reason, the extended supersymmetry is of no use to particle phenomenology. Right. So there is, if I will have time, if we will actually go to n equal 2 supersymmetric gauge theories, then there will be there will be sort of a central charge extension of this algebra, and there will be the algebra will imply the existence of very special type of monopoles. Okay, they will preserve half of the supersymmetry, so the so-called BPS state. So we will talk about that once we handle the minimal supersymmetry. All right. So. All right, guys. So what we're going to do now, we're going to forget about these beautiful things, And we're going to go and study supersymmetric quantum mechanics. And the reason why we will study supersymmetric quantum mechanics so that we develop a much closer intuition about SUSY field series. And when we will discuss this quantum mechanics, I will say, OK, this feature is generic, and this is special to quantum mechanics and things like that. The things that you will see here is that how dangerous it is to rely on perturbative computations. So you will see in the example of quantum mechanics that if you do perturbative computation, then the answer you get are in contradiction with with non-perturbative results, because we can solve supersymmetric quantum mechanics non-perturbative. All right, so again, the main advantage of supersymmetric quantum mechanics, it's a supersymmetric field theory, but it doesn't have any indices. Okay, so let's create our supersymmetric quantum mechanics. So quantum mechanics equals to quantum field theory in 0 plus 1 dimensional spacetime. And so in quantum field theories, we have Poincaré translations, and that correspond to the conservation of energy momentum tensor. So in this case, the analog of the Poincaré translations so here we have only time directions to translate with, so the Poincaré translations will become time translations. And so associated with Poincaré translations, there was a conserved spin one charge, which is energy momentum tensor. So in this case, we have just a single component of energy momentum tensor, and it will be a Hamiltonian of a system that's going to be conserved. Okay. So let me show you how, given what we have on this blackboard, we can sort of guess the supersymmetric quantum mechanics. Likewise, I could have just written you the algebra and said this is a supersymmetric quantum mechanics, but I want to give you a little bit more than that. Well, as usual, it is a zeros component with an upper index that corresponds to the energy, and so it's natural to identify this. So if we do this, then once we lower the component, this will be minus the energy. Now, if I look at the first anti-commutator, right? So I have a charge Q, and then I have a charge Q bar. The beauty of this supersymmetric quantum mechanics is that there will be only one set of Q and Q bars, and so now, all this index contraction with respect to mu will be just a first sigma matrix. And if you go back and look in the notes, what we are looking for sigma zero with component 1, 1 times p mu with a lower index, that's minus h. And this guy happened to be minus 1, and so we have 2h. So the analog of the first anti-commutator relation simply tells us that QQ bar closes on a Hamiltonian of the system. And two remaining ones, QQ equals to 0, and Q bar equals to 0. So it's, if you wish, I told you how it can come from a general supersymmetry algebra. And you can see that it's much, much simpler. There is no spin A indices whatsoever. All right? So this is an algebra. It's a well-defined algebra. And what we can do, we can just study the properties of this algebra and what that would imply about the quantum mechanics. That's what we're going to do. So I told you that H is a Hamiltonian, and this Q is a supercharge.
Because there is no minus. Okay. Right, guys. So I should never done it before. I turned off this. But my wife tries to call me 3 times now, and we have a 6-month-old baby. So if you mind, I'll just ask what's going on. Is that okay? So just for a second. She knows they have a lecture. She keeps calling.
Yeah, thank you. So there is this. U bar H. Yeah. In a quantum mechanics, so this is the simplest, you know, the alpha. So we formulate, okay, so the way we started, and once we translated the Lorentz symmetry into SL to C, that was for four-dimensional space-time, right? But if you wish, this is a shape, I didn't say this, maybe I should have said, that the algebras that I wrote have the same structure in any dimension, okay? So the dimensionality, the range, what alpha will run, will depend what dimension of the space-time you look at. And in some space-time dimensions, you can have supersymmetry, in some you cannot. Okay, so there is a restriction on the dimensionality of the space in which you can have different kinds of supersymmetry. So in odd dimensions you cannot.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I said the wrong thing.
So I'm confused about, like, yeah. I thought that if you have just normal quantum mechanics, right, you also have rotational symmetries and space translations.
No, we don't, because we don't have something to rotate with respect. We don't have space. We have a wave function, and those wave functions depend on time. Right? If I do a Schrodinger equation, in the Schrodinger equation, the only thing that we have is just a wave function. It depends on we have space. Right. So we have a coordinate and we have a conjugate momentum, but those are operators in your supersymmetric quantum mechanics. Maybe that's what I'm going to say this. So as far as the analog of space-time, the quantum mechanics has only time. Doesn't have any space. So X is an operator.
Okay.
Okay? In quantum mechanics. Okay. So in other words, this is actually, you are always about 15 seconds ahead of me, which is great, which means that you guys are indeed. So the analog of X, if you ask, I told you, the quantum mechanics is quantum field theory in 0 plus 1, right?
Yeah.
So you can ask, what is x? That's I guess, your question. What's x in quantum mechanics from the perspective of quantum physics? So the envelope of x is a field. X corresponds to phi in quantum field theory.
So this is 1D quantum mechanics, or?
No, that's a zero. Quantum mechanics, by definition, is zero dimension. And the coordinate, okay, so.
This to know space dimension set the mixture of time, basically, that's what you mean. So the Lorentz group would be.
Right, so if you wish the number, well, I don't know how to say it in other ways, right? So you have a time direction, and you ask, so there is a translational invariance, and can you formulate a Lorentz algebra in which there are boosts in some in some spatial direction that you cannot in quantum mechanics. So, but saying, just expanding on what you just said, so we can go ahead and we can construct again sort of. The relation between quantum mechanics and quantum field theory.
Okay, and so this is what you were saying. You were saying, well, there is a coordinate and there is a conjugate momentum, right? So this is coordinate, and there is a conjugate and there is a conjugate momentum. So those are operators. So in quantum field theory, a coordinate would correspond to a generalized coordinate or a field, right? So we have phi that corresponds to a coordinate. So this is generalized coordinate. Well, in quantum field theory, this is just a field. And then there will be a conjugate, so field is an operator, right? And then there will be a conjugate operator to it, right? So much like P. And so I'm going to call this pi, okay? And the conjugate operator, okay, so I will write down, but it will have exactly the same relation as P, right? So if I'm going to write it down as a differential operator, then it's d over dx, and so this pi is minus pi h bar del over del phi. Okay. All right. So I think one thing that I did, well, I said this, but let me say it again. So this q is a supercharge. So in other words, in a supersymmetric quantum mechanics, we have a Hamiltonian, which is a conserved quantity, and another thing, we have a supercharge. Yes. So from this perspective, they would correspond to just instead of having a single field, there will be more fields. And we want to look at the simplest model because, we discuss the simplest model in order to understand the features, and then we immediately jump into a four-dimensional supersymmetry. So, all right. So very good. So let's start with a statement that is valid everywhere in any supersymmetric theories. So the statement is that Susi algebra implies that the energy spectrum is positive. So there cannot be tachyons. Whenever we have a supersymmetry, there cannot be tachyons in the spectrum. And that's a very general statement. And we're going to show this. We're going to show this just using a supersymmetry algebra. So suppose that we have a state, okay? A state. We can think of this as an eigenstate. eigenstate of our Hamiltonian, right? And so since it is an eigenstate, then H acted on our state will give us the energy of the state. And so what we're going to do, we're going to show using the supersymmetry algebra that for any state n, okay, so I guess I'm assuming that we have a discrete spectrum, we have a mass gap in this supersymmetric quantum mechanics, E sub n is larger or equal than zero. So that's a very powerful statement, but it's a very trivial statement to prove, okay? So let's look at this. Expectation value, there are two ways I can evaluate it. I can evaluate it directly by using the fact that omega n are eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, and that gives me En. But there is another way I can evaluate it using a supersymmetry algebra. And so according to supersymmetry algebra, the Hamiltonian here is an anti-commutator of a supercharges. So I can write this down as 1 half omega n q, so q bar is the same as q dagger. So sometimes I will be switching notations. With a factor of 1 half, right? And that thing here is 1 half. Q dagger acted on omega, absolute value squared, plus 1 half, absolute value of Q acted on omega squared. So we have a sum of absolute values squared, and it's never negative, and it's equal to the energy. So that tells us that the spectrum of a supersymmetry algebra is bounded from below, and in fact, it's bounded by zero. Now, that's one statement that is very general. There is another very general statement, and it's actually very powerful. So, yeah. No, keep doing. That's great. Yeah.
The U1H transformations in the field, right? And then the rotations would be SO3 gauge transformations.
Right, once you want to extend it to a flat,
that's really interesting. So here, in this way of thinking of it, the translations of space and normal quantities are just gauge transformations in the field. Right?
Yeah, so
well, it's not a gauge transformation, I guess, because there's no custom gauge filter.
It's more like global, I guess, for global to the transition state, it's going to be a global symmetry. Which is
they're global.
Yeah, so, which is what the phase in quantum mechanics, right?
Yeah. That's right.
All right. So there is a special state, right? So there is a special state, and so let's look at the so the lowest energy state is E equals zero. So that's a lowest possible energy state. Okay, and so what we're going to show now is that. Or the ground state, if you will. Ground state. I'm going to call ground state. And by that, I mean the state of zero energy. The statement is that ground state preserves supersymmetry. Okay? So suppose we have a state omega. Suppose we have some state omega. A little bit later, I'm going to write down explicitly the action of supersymmetry generators and so on. But for now, it's enough to do this. So suppose I have a state, and I will act on this state with infinitesimal. Susi transformation. Okay? So it's an infinitesimal Susi transformation, so it will move me away slightly from the original state. So I will have the resulting state will be epsilon. And then there will be, in general, I would expect out to some numbers. So epsilon will be my epsilon and epsilon bar are these infinitesimal parameters that specify the supersymmetry transformations. And they must be related to these supercharges, because supercharges are conserved quantities associated with supersymmetry transformations. So so my state should transform somehow in this manner. Okay? And so if the state is a ground state, now notice what happens. If omega is a ground state, okay, then this means, by our definition, what the ground state is, that the energy of this state equals to zero. But then, using a supersymmetry algebra, this means that when I act with the supersymmetry charges on this state, I should get zero. Right? Because the only way how I can get zero when you have a sum of two squares, absolute value of squares, if each of them is zero. What does this mean? This means that if I do a supersymmetry transformation acted on this state, the state doesn't change. So we showed that a ground state is invariant under supersymmetry transformations. So I'm going to write this down in words. And those are statement true in general supersymmetric models. So a ground state is invariant under Susi transformations. Yeah, it's a little bit funny because I haven't told you exactly how the supersymmetry transformation acts, but hang on, we'll talk about that. So ground state is invariant, but second thing, ground state. Ground state is annihilated by all supercharges. Okay. So this is a very general statement which happened also, for example, in string theory. If we construct set and background in string theory, we talk only about bosonic fields. And how do we know that? How do we know that that background that we construct is supersymmetric? There will be a supersymmetry generators, and there will be a supercharges associated with a particular string model. And so, what we can do, we can take those supercharges and we can act on our background that involves only bosonic fields, and we can ask, will we get zero or not? So, if we talk about the background in string theory, which would be annihilated by the action of the supercharges, then our background is supersymmetric. So that's why I keep saying that those features are very general, and they happen every time in supersymmetric models. And it's very easy to understand here in quantum mechanics. However, that is all very nice, but this ground state does not necessarily have to exist. So a ground state, so we can have a theory, where there is a supersymmetry, but that theory might not have a ground state. Okay, does not necessarily exist. Some example that you guys would know is that I can look at field theory, right? And I can look at this Mexican half potential, or even simpler if I have a real field with a symmetric potential of this type. So this theory has a Z2 symmetry, but there is no Z2 symmetric ground state. in this model, so this is fine, and what I plot B of phi. So there is a Z2 symmetry. Symmetry where phi goes to minus phi, but there is no symmetric Z2 symmetric Brown state. So in this case, what we're going to say is that our global symmetry Z2 is spontaneously broken. ZQ is spontaneously broken. Now, once we talk about the quantum mechanics, in order to make the quantum mechanics supersymmetric, well, you will see that we can construct quantum mechanics with pretty much any potential. So write down any potential energy, right? So say a harmonic oscillator and any generalization of that. And what could happen is that if I write down the potential energy in the quantum mechanics, and we'll talk about this in a couple of minutes. So suppose that the potential energy is such that it's something like this, okay? So there is simply no, no ground state. So if I give you this potential, so what I'm plotting here is x, this is B of x, and so there is no in this potential, there is no minimum with potential energy equal to zero. And so I just told you that I will be able to generalize quantum mechanics with arbitrary potential to supersymmetric quantum mechanics. And so in this particular case, what we will have is that there will be no ground state. So the model will be supersymmetric, but there will be no supersymmetric ground state. So in the cases when the ground state does not exist, we will say exactly the same words as we were saying there. So we will say that SUSY is spontaneously broken. Okay. And so in real world, you can try to model our series using some high dimensional model, string theory or whatever. So sometimes the consistency of those models might require the supersymmetry, but in real world it must be broken. And so something that we will discuss in this course is how the supersymmetry is broken. What are the mechanisms for breaking the supersymmetry? All right, so very good. Right, in order for that to be, as you know, there will be no Goldstone boson, right, in that case, because it's a discrete symmetry. So in the case of supersymmetric quantum mechanics, the situation is very similar to that. So there will be no Goldstone boson. Fermion. All right. So what we're going to do now, we're going to study the properties of a spectrum of supersymmetric quantum mechanics. Okay, so we have a Hamiltonian in our quantum mechanics, so what we can do is diagonalize. We can diagonalize our Hamiltonian, and I'm going to denote those states by n. So what this means that h acted on n are our eigenstates, okay? And then when I evaluate this on n, I will get 2 E n
and we just argued that it should be non-negative. So there are two possibilities, two cases that we need to discuss. So we know that the spectrum is bounded from below by zero. And what we will look now at the spectrum, the states in the spectrum, which have a positive energy, and then we will go and look at the ground states. Okay, so we will look at the state, possible states, where the energy equals to zero. So in this case, I can define new operators. Okay, so we are discussing this now. So I can define new operators. I can call A dagger equals Q dagger, square root of En. Actually, let me be more precise, square root of 2En. And then I can introduce operator A over 2En. Okay, so what I am doing now, there is a big Hilbert space, and I concentrate, I ask the question, what are the states in this Hilbert space that have energy En? It's non-zero energy. So I pick up those states from the Hilbert space, and I want to see how the supersymmetry, what does the supersymmetry algebra are doing with those states in the Hilbert space. So this is a small set of the states. And so once I restrict my Hilbert space to those states, I can introduce these new operators, A dagger and A, defined as this. And so on this subset of states, I don't know how many of them are there, how do they transform into each other, but I know that once I restrict the supersymmetry algebra to those states, I will get this. Okay, so our supersymmetry algebra happen to be a two-dimensional Clifford algebra when restricted to those states. So this is 2D Clifford algebra. And now we can ask, what's the representation theory of this two-dimensional Clifford algebra? And it's actually very simple. So I'm sure that you already know this, but let me just mention this just to be so that we are all on the same footing. One of the statements of the Clifford algebra is that A squared is zero, okay, on the states in the representation in this Clifford algebra. So what this means, that if I take any state, if I can take any state, let me actually do this. A dagger plus equal to zero. So if I look at this, then I have a state omega in this algebra, and then I have this state. And I cannot have anything else, okay? Because I cannot act with a dagger more, because a dagger squared vanishes. So in other words, I guess I should have said that in order to build up the representation, choose state omega such that A acted on omega. This state is annihilated by the annihilation operator. And so once we choose a state like this, then all other states we construct by acting with the creation operator. And there is only one time we can act with the creation operator. And so then the way how supersymmetry algebra will act on those states is this. So this is what I call omega. So it's annihilated here. A dagger acted on the minus state will give me a plus state. A acted on a plus state will give me a minus state. and a dagger acted on a plus state gives you zero. So in other words, representation of two-dimensional Clifford algebra is two-dimensional, and we built up that representation. So what this tells us, that if we look in a supersymmetric quantum mechanics at the state where the energy is not zero, so this, so we will call this a multiplet. And so in this multiplet, there will be two states in SUSY multiplet, with positive energy. So there will be two states in this representation. What I want to do, I want somehow distinguish those two states, okay? And the way how I'm going to distinguish it, I'm going to introduce a fermion number. I want to warn you that the fermion number is not a good defined quantity for supersymmetric quantum mechanics, there is a nice generalization to this in quantum field theories. So for us, the purpose of introducing a fermion number is to introduce some operator that would allow us to distinguish different states in the same supersymmetry multiplet. That's the logic. Why do we introduce a fermion number? So we introduce a fermion number operator F to distinguish states in SUSY multiplet. Okay, and so the way I'm going to do this, so this SUSY operator, when I act on a plus state, I will get plus one. And when I act with the supersymmetry, so this is just definition, okay? So I'm going to define my fermion numbers in this way. Zero, so the fermion number actually annihilates that minus state. So I should be able to write down this fermion number operator in terms of my A dagger and A, which are the basic building blocks of a supersymmetry algebra. And in fact, there is such a representation. So if, so what I did, I actually denoted a fermion number is A dagger A. And indeed, you can see that that's the way how it acts on different different states in the Clifford algebra representation there. So the thing that we will talk about is minus one to the F. Just one second, let me write it down. This. So if I act on it with if I act with this operator on a plus state, I will get minus. Okay, so this is a little bit confusing, but that's actually a definition that I will use, and that's a definition which is easy to extend to higher dimensions and to quantum field theory. Okay, yes. At this stage, it's just a label, okay? So in there, right, so again, it's a very good question. Because the question is actually in the context of in the context of supersymmetric quantum mechanics, I cannot ask this, because in order for me to distinguish whether I have a boson or fermion, I need to rotate in a space, and I just told you that in quantum mechanics there is zero spatial dimension, so I cannot distinguish bosons versus fermions, but I can do that in, for example, 2 plus 1 dimensional quantum field theory, right? So now I have two spatial directions, and I can ask how does my states transform under the rotation here along the z-axis, And so when you formulate supersymmetric quantum field theory in three-dimensional space-time, then actually in other space-times as well, you can assign a fermion number as an operator which corresponds to a rotation around a particular axis, okay? And then that will really have a meaning whether you have a fermions or bosons, because the question will be whether the states after you do 2-pi rotation, whether the states will pick up -1 or 1. And that will distinguish states of integer spin versus the states of a half integer spin. Okay, so in other words, in higher dimensions, that will really be something that distinguishes bosons versus fermions. And so if you wish, I cannot have a simple physical argument why that will immediately correspond to this. So for our, in our case, it will be just the labels in order to break degeneracy in the multiplet, right? For now, our multiplet has two states, and that label will tell us why one state is different from the other, which will be a very useful label when we start discussing the non-perturbative effects and what interesting stuff can happen in supersymmetric quantum mechanics. All right, so good. So, so what we did with you, we discussed the spectrum and the representation of a supersymmetry algebra on a multiplet with non-vanishing energy. And so the next natural thing, what will happen with the ground state? Okay. So so this is II. So we look at the ground state. So we assume that there is a ground state and it has a zero energy. And we just argued before that whenever once it is a ground state, then it must be annihilated by supersymmetry generators. And so it tells us that that immediately tells us that the ground state can only be in a trivial representation, okay? So if I have a ground state, I cannot construct a new state in a supersymmetry multiplet by acting with a supersymmetry generators, okay? Notice that the states in a supersymmetry multiplet here are related by the action of the supercharges. So here, this statement tells me that the representation of the ground state must be trivial. It's a one-dimensional representation. I cannot construct a new state by acting with a supercharge, okay? Because a supercharge will annihilate the state. I cannot get a new state. So representation are trivial. But that doesn't say that there must be, well, in principle, there could be several ground states, right? So it doesn't say, in other words, we can have a reducible representation of a supersymmetry algebra on a ground state. We will see if that is possible or not. All right, very good. Now, in the case, notice that for the positive energy state, I define an operator using the supercharges pretty much that produce me a fermion number. So if I'm in a ground state, it's annihilated by all supercharges. It's annihilated by all elements in my supersymmetry algebra. So strictly speaking, I cannot construct -1 to ZF. And so what this means, but I can still assign the action of the fermion number operator on the ground state. And the thing is that it can be either plus one or minus one. Okay? So the ground state can be either a fermion or boson. All right, so very good. So it's a great place to stop, because what we did with you, we understood the representation theory of the supersymmetric algebra, the simplest one, and then we will write down an explicit quantum mechanics next time, and it will be quantum mechanics of a spin 1/2 particle. And there we will write down explicit expressions for the supercharges, the Hamiltonian, and so on, and solve that theory exactly, non-perturbative. But then we will solve it perturbative and see where did we go wrong.